1,000 federal ICE agents are currently deployed in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in operation what they are calling Metro Surge. Posting on social media, Trump wrote, quote, if the corrupt politicians of Minnesota don't obey the law and stop the professional agitators and insurrectionists from attacking the patriots of ICE, who are only trying to do their job, I will institute the Insurrection Act, he said. Protests against the ICE crackdown in Minnesota are ongoing, have only intensified since last week's shooting of Renee Good, a U.S. citizen, poet, and mother of three. Trump's comments came after a second person was shot by ICE. Julio Cesar Sosa Celis is a Venezuelan national shot in the leg following a traffic stop in the Twin Cities. This is White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt speaking to reporters yesterday.
The Insurrection Act is a tool at the president's disposal. As you know, it has been used sparingly, but it has been used by previous presidents in American history. And I think the president's Truth Social post spoke very loud and clear to Democrats across this country, elected officials who are using their platforms to encourage violence against federal law enforcement officers, who are encouraging left-wing agitators to unlawfully obstruct legitimate law enforcement operations.
For more, we're joined by Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to talk about what's happening with the Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil. But we wanted to start by talking about the Insurrection Act. What does this mean that Trump could invoke it? What does it mean for Minnesota and the country?
Well, just to say, the invocation of the Insurrection Act, which is an invocation of martial law, is like equal parts, you know, lawless and terrifying. In this country, we are not in a constitutional republic, you're not supposed to have the military policing municipalities, because the military, if you think about it, is not subject to law. It's subject to executive will and power, and we're governed by municipalities are policed by police departments that are accountable to the mayor and to the public. So the Insurrection Act does permit the use of the military in extremely limited circumstances, where, for example, there's an insurrection, which is, it was used by Lincoln during the Civil War, Sherman trying to crush Klan terrorism in Reconstruction, and to integrate Southern schools. But the insurrection that's supposedly happening here is, as they say in horror movies, coming from inside the house. It's not from the people of Minneapolis. It's from the ICE paramilitary ICE agents themselves who are fomenting this violence. And I'd note, you know, Trump probably sees this as a civil war. He's inverting the reasons for using the Insurrection Act, which had been to tamp white supremacy in the past, and now it's being used to support it.
And could you talk about the most recent use of the Insurrection Act back in 1992 and during the Rodney King riots in L.A., the difference between that situation and what we're seeing across the country now?
Well, first, there was, you know, bona fide, demonstrable violence, and where the police department, which requested aid in L.A., could not control themselves. There's no actual violence here, except that being perpetrated by the instigators, which is this paramilitary force of ICE. Local officials have not requested, in fact, rejected aid, and the motives are different. There, at least, there was a bona fide belief that the violence required additional police support via the military. Here, this, as we all know, is being leveraged as part of an autocratic power grab, and wait till there's maybe just a simple flare-up during a midterm election, and if the military gets deployed at that time as well.
And, of course, this comes in the aftermath of the Supreme Court striking down President Trump's attempts to mobilize National Guard troops to Chicago and other cities. Could you talk about the connection there?
Yeah, surprisingly, for this Supreme Court, they instituted some limitations on the possibility of using at least the National Guard. This is a slightly different legal question. I'm a little bit worried, given this court's fascinated embrace of executive power that they would give the Trump administration more leeway to use its, you know, judgment and discretion to deploy military force. But we need to be obviously in the courts and in the streets protesting this kind of gratuitous use of military violence.
We want to turn to another issue. A federal appeals court has reversed a ruling that freed the Palestinian activist, the Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil, from Louisiana ICE jail in June. Advocates fear the move could pave the way for the Trump administration to rearrest and deport him. Mahmoud Khalil was arrested and jailed in March for taking part in campus protests at Columbia University as a graduate student. He was the first non-citizen student targeted and arrested by the Trump administration for pro-Palestine speech, detained for months, first in New Jersey, then in Louisiana, before a federal district judge in New Jersey granted a habeas petition in his case, saying his constitutional rights had likely been violated. Now, in a split 2-1 decision, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned that ruling on jurisdictional grounds, saying Khalil should have first appealed his removal in immigration court. For more, we're still joined by Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, as well as Mahmoud Khalil himself, who's joining us via Zoom. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Mahmoud. Can you talk about your response to the judge's decision and what this means for you and your family, your wife and your baby Dean, who was born while you were imprisoned in Louisiana?
This ruling is absolutely disappointing. This administration, the Trump administration, is trying everything in its power to come after me, to put the full weight of the government to actually make an example out of me. And this means that I would be separated from my U.S. wife and son, who both were born in this country. It underscores how this administration is weaponizing the legal system, how fragile due process can be when our rights are treated as conditional rather than guaranteed. And I must be clear, like it's absolutely, I have an amazing team. You have Bahar with you in the studio. We're going to explore every avenue until we feel vindicated. Yet this administration will continue to go to these ideological judges to get rulings in their favor. And basically, as you said, what they want me to do is to wait for an immigration process that's fully completed, fully controlled by the Trump administration to get justice from this process, which is, we know this wouldn't happen, that this immigration judge, quote unquote, will not let us develop our case to bring it on appeal. So imagine that I have to wait to do that. And 10 months now after my detention, the U.S. government has not brought a shred of evidence that I broke any laws, that I spoke anything in support of terrorist organizations, yet they continue to weaponize the legal system.
Well, Mahmoud, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has claimed that your very presence spreads anti-Semitism, your very presence in this country. How do you respond to this Trump administration narrative that they've created about you?
No, I mean, this is an administration that spreads hate. This is an administration that actually embraces the actual anti-Semites, that supports the new Nazi parties across Europe. To come and claim that my presence here is about anti-Semitism, it's not. You know, I'm here to support Palestinian rights, the fundamental rights of the Palestinian people for their self-determination. Determination and liberation. We told them we want to see them in court, and that's what they don't want to do. They want to take this case into immigration court, which they fully control. So we don't have to present, or they don't have to present any evidence. And as Judge Young yesterday In another case in Massachusetts said that what happened in this case is essentially an unconstitutional conspiracy between Rubio himself and NEOM, the Secretary of Homeland Security, to pick up certain people, to twist the laws, and to go after people they don't like. This is a judge, a Reagan appointee judge, who said that they are conspiring to do that, to make an example out of me, so they chill the speech of everyone in this country, regardless of their status.
So you were the first of the students to be arrested. Then there was Mohsen Madawi, who's now a Columbia graduate student. There was Reza Ozturk, who was a Tufts graduate student, all released. You have filed a $20 million lawsuit against the Trump administration, claiming you were falsely imprisoned, maliciously prosecuted, deliberately smeared. And in the case, Judge William Young called Mr. Trump an authoritarian and said the administration's actions targeting non-citizen student protesters violated the First Amendment. That decision only applies to members of two academic organizations in the case. If you can respond to that, Bahar, and Mahmoud, if you can respond to this lawsuit that you have filed against the Trump administration. Start with Mahmoud.
Absolutely. I mean, we're seeking accountability for all the injustices that happened against me and against other students. And this administration needs to pay for all these lawless actions that they are committing. So this is just like one action towards that end. And this is why they are retaliating against me, because I'm also standing up against their actions, and they don't like that. They want people to just submit to their authoritarian practices and to their lawlessness, which I will not make that happen. I will continue my advocacy until Palestine is free.
How do you keep Mahmoud Khalil free, Bahar?
Well, just to reassure everyone, this decision taking away jurisdiction from the district court doesn't immediately go into effect. So the order releasing him is still in effect and will be in effect until the appeals process is exhausted. And we have a number of legal options to continue to seek to revise or reverse this split 2-1 decision, which comes over a very persuasive dissent and which is contrary to decisions in other courts of appeals. But ultimately, Judge Young is right. This is an authoritarian action by this government. He also just talked about how Rubio and others have a fear of freedom. Imagine being so cowardly and ashamed of the First Amendment that rather take on the speech that you disagree with, you try and imprison those who dissent from U.S. foreign policy. That's the classic kind of extrajudicial detention or arbitrary detention that's the hallmark of autocratic regimes.
But Bahar, this whole issue of Judge Young's decision on the free speech rights of non-citizens, the appeals panel claiming that he lacked subject matter jurisdiction. Could you explain the logic of that?
Yeah. So to be clear, the appeals court in the headquarters in Philadelphia did not take on the illegality of the detention, which basically every court that has reviewed this policy has found unconstitutional. It's cited a technical jurisdictional provision of the immigration laws to say that the federal court, which is a constitutional court, cannot hear these claims. It has to be put through the immigration process and the immigration courts. But what people need to understand is the immigration courts are not real courts. They're part of the executive branch. That's why we wanted our constitutional claims to be heard in a real court, a real constitutional court. That's where these kind of constitutional claims can be, not in a court that rubber stamps the executive branch's policies.
Just going to end this segment with New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani posting on social media, quote, last year's arrest of Mahmoud Khalil was more than just a chilling act of political repression. It was an attack on all of our constitutional rights. Now, as the crackdown on pro-Palestinian free speech continues, Mahmoud is being threatened with rearrest. Mahmoud is free and must remain free. The mayor of New York City said, that's Zohran Mamdani. Your final response, Mahmoud Khalil, as you sit here in New York City, now a free man.
I would say, like, this is all these attempts are just to really distract us from what's really happening, which is Israel genocide in Gaza and Israel's action against Palestinians in whole of Palestine, and also to distract from the fact that this administration just 2 days ago sent $3.3 billion to Israel from our money, from our tax money. And this is why I was protesting, and this is why I would continue to protest.
Palestinian activist and Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil and Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Coming up, we speak to the Palestinian-American director and actress Shireen Debee. Stay with us. By Ahmed Ali Arslan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a feature film that looks at seven decades of Palestinian history through the lens of one family's experience over three generations, beginning in 1948. The film is All That's Left of You by the Palestinian-American director and actress Shireen Diabas. The film is Jordan's official entry for the International Feature Oscar. It's been shortlisted. This is the trailer.
We should go home.
Why, are you scared?
No one ever thought any of us would have been. I'm here to tell you how it started.
I am the sea. In my depths, all treasures dwell.
They take your land, your money. Call this a life? Don't be foolish, son.
Hey,
Get on the ground. Get on the ground.
I wanted to protect you. I was afraid for you.
As long as Dad is here, you don't have to be scared.
What use are we as parents if we can't protect our kids?
Your humanity is also resistance. Don't forget the power of your humanity. It's the one thing no one can take away from you.
I wanted to explain why we are here, what my family went through.
That was the trailer for the film All That's Left of You. Appearing in the film is the renowned Palestinian and actor and director Mohammed Bakri, who died in December at the age of 72. Bakri appears in the film alongside his sons, Adam and Saleh, who are also actors. This is a clip from the film depicting a loving and playful interaction between a grandfather, Mohammed, and a grandson, played by Sanad Al-Kabaretti.
The military invasion of Lebanon, known as Operation Litani, and the following massacres.
What's the rush? Can't even greet your grandpa, your sweetheart, your best friend? Who else do you have? What a crazy family. I smell the scent of a human.
Grandpa.
Smell.
I'm too old for that game.
Too old. You? With Grandpa, you can never grow up, especially not with this game. Take it back. Take it back. Take it back.
No.
Take it back.
Okay, I take it back.
How was school?
Boring.
I had a feeling you'd say that. That's why I have a surprise for you.
A clip from the film All That's Left of You, featuring the late, great actor Mohammed Bakri, who passed away in December. We're joined now in the studio by the film's director and star, Shireen Diavis. It's great to have you with us, Shireen. What a powerful film. It's opening in New York in three theaters. It's now there. You're doing the Q&As in all these theaters at the Angelica and New Plaza, as well as Kips Bay and Los Angeles and San Francisco, and opening all over the country. Tell us the story, this multi-generational narrative that is so critical to understand today.
Well, the story follows one Palestinian family and traces really love and loss over three generations from 1948 until almost the present day. And really, it's the story about how history shapes us. It's about how political events shape people and change relationships within family, and really change the fates of families. That's really the story. But I think at its heart, it's really about the extraordinary will that it takes to survive political turmoil and personal loss. And, you know, if you want to probe even deeper, I think it's really about choosing our humanity, you know, looking for meaning in grief, and choosing humanity even in the most difficult of circumstances, which Palestinians have done and do every single day. But, you know, for some reason, the world just never gets to see that.
And Shireen, you began shooting this film in the occupied West Bank before October 7, 2023. But then after the Hamas attack and Israel's genocidal launching of a genocidal war on Gaza, you continued to film in the West Bank, even as Israeli attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank escalated. Could you talk about the impact on your crew as you were doing this filming and the war was continuing to expand in Gaza?
Well, we actually evacuated shortly after the events of October the 7th. We were based in Ramallah at that time. We had prepped the entire film. We had spent months working with a huge crew on the ground in Palestine. I had foreign crew who had arrived in Palestine in early October of 2023. And really within days of October the 7th, things became extremely tense. West Bank cities and towns were being sealed off, checkpoints were closing, and it was clear that we weren't going to be able to move around. My foreign crew wanted to evacuate. Their families were worried. They were scared. And so by October the 10th, we were forced to evacuate. At that point, we went to Cyprus, where we had always planned to shoot a small part of the film. And we decided to start with that small part and, you know, thinking perhaps we can then return to Palestine. But, you know, the situation continued to escalate and escalate, which forced us to make a decision. You know, we either delay the film and wait to return to Palestine, or we continue making it and, you know, we go to Jordan. And we decided to continue. We had a lot of momentum. And we didn't want to delay in getting this important story out, knowing everything that was happening. You know, one of the most challenging things, I think, was really making a movie about what was happening as it was happening. You know, we found ourselves making this film about the ongoing Nakba as we're witnessing an even bigger Nakba. And it was like life and art were merging, and we were suddenly shooting scenes that we were witnessing come out of Gaza. And that took a huge emotional toll on all of us. It was extremely, you know, challenging and painful. But in many ways, the film became a container for our love, for our compassion, for our grief, and we just poured ourselves into it. And in that way, the film was really such a gift to be able to create at a time of such devastating destruction.
And can you talk about, I mean, this film is released as Mohamed Bakri dies, one of the stars in your film, a man you have worked with, his whole family, Salah, we've had on Democracy Now! As well, his son who stars in this, Adam, his son, what it meant for this to come out in the aftermath of his death, but also the moral dilemma at the heart of the film. It's a spoiler alert, so I won't say what it is.
Well, I mean, I will say, you know, working with Mohamed was such an honor for me. I had been a huge fan for so long. He's a giant of Palestinian cinema. You know, his 5-decade spanning career really happened alongside the creation of Palestinian cinema, the rise of Palestinian cinema. And he's sort of one of the founders of that. And I had been just a longtime admirer, had always wanted to work with him, such a fan of his kids as well. 5 out of 6 of them are actors. And so there's this, you know, Palestinian family acting dynasty. And as I was casting this intergenerational portrait, it was my dream to really cast an actual family in these roles. Working with Mohamed was just amazing. I mean, he's so disciplined. He's so rigorous. He's so committed. He has more integrity than anyone I've ever met. And he just was so there and present and you know, the kind of actor who, you know, I would call cut and he would say, no, let's do it again. Let's do it again. I can do better. Just always really striving to kind of be his best. And you can see that in his work and the immense depth and nuance and humanity and humor that he brings to the film. You know, I'm so happy that he actually got to tap into that, that talent of his, because, you know, he hadn't gotten to do a lot of comedy. He did come to our European premiere where he saw the film for the very first time this summer, and he just was so proud of the film.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation. We want folks to go to democracynow.org to see it. Shireen Diabas, Palestinian-American director, producer, screenwriter, actress. Her feature film, All That's Left of You, has been shortlisted for an Oscar. It's opening around the country. It's in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco now. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Are you an artist, band, or record label? We want you to send us your music so we can put it on the radio. Not only this station, but stations across Canada. Check out earshot-distro.ca and share your music with more than 100 radio stations and programmers across the country. Earshot Distro is made by and for the campus community radio sector to help emerging musicians. Uploads cost $7 per song or $50 per album. Learn more at earshot-distro.ca.